This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're pleased to bring you what we think is a profound analysis of the Trump phenomena.
We believe it's neo-fascism. We use the word quite purposely, because if you don't know what it is, you can't fight it.
We'll also talk with ex-trial lawyer and history professor Benjamin Hett, who wrote Crossing Hitler, the man who put the Nazis on the witness stand.
Hans Litten, a three-hour cross-examination of Hitler before the Reichstag fire. He paid dearly for it. It's an amazingly heroic story with chilling parallels for today. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Is Donald Trump a neo-fascist? Thoughtful analysts on the left, like Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, and Judith Butler, think he is. But mainstream liberal commentators refuse to associate the Trump phenomena with fascism. They call him a right-wing populist. What is neo-fascism? Right-wing populism? Does it really matter what Trump is called? The great German playwright and political thinker who lived in Germany during Hitler's reign, Bertolt Brecht, asked in 1935, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" We speak today with John Bellamy Foster, editor of the venerable magazine Monthly Review. He wrote the lead article in the current June 2017 issue titled, "Why It's Not Populism." John Bellamy Foster is a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. He writes about the political economy of capitalism and ecological crisis. John Bellamy Foster, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
You think that we should characterize Donald Trump and his regime as neo-fascist. Why is it important to distinguish between calling Trumpism right-wing populist, as is commonly done, and neo-fascist, as you believe?
Well, it's a difficult issue because the term fascist is sometimes used just as a term of abuse, but words matter, and our conceptions matter. And to say Trump is a right-wing populist doesn't really tell us very much. Populist, in the way they're using it now, just means somebody, whether on the right or the left, who's critical of the liberal democratic center that's dominated U.S. politics and that has a mass following. So they refer to people such as Hitler or Chavez, Bernie Sanders, Marine Le Pen. All sorts of people all over the political spectrum as populist, simply because they are opposed to the center that has dominated U.S. and world politics. So you really have to talk about what something is. In order to understand it, you have to get down to the roots of the phenomenon. And in Europe, it's well known that there has been a transnational neo-fascist movement, and it has a very clear political, social basis, and it's part of the whole long genus of fascist movements. To understand this allows us to understand what is happening today, to put Trump and his movement in context, and to be able to struggle against it.
John, at the outset of your monthly review article, "This Is Not Populism," you quote Adolf Hitler, who said, quote, "I am concerned with power politics. That is to say, I make use of all means that seem to me to be of service, without the slightest concern for the proprieties or for codes of honor." We presume you had Donald Trump in mind?
Yes, of course, and I thought people would immediately get it. It sounded as if it came out of Trump's mouth and really described him in some ways.
Write about Germany, and you talk about what classes in Germany Hitler drew his support. And do you think that there's a similarity in Germany and now here in the United States with Trump and where he gets his support?
Yes, there's. I was very influenced by a Gallup study that came out that said exactly that. It came out in, I think it was in early November, not long before the election. But there's quite an understanding of this in the literature. The Hitler's support came, his electoral support in the beginning when he was running for office, was from the lower middle class, or petty bourgeoisie, as they sometimes call it, and from some privileged sectors of the working class, but particularly from what we know as the lower middle class, the semi-professionals, the lower-level white-collar workers, owners of small businesses, and people who are better off than the working class in general, but in a fairly precarious position. And then he drew support from privileged sectors of the working class, from rural voters, from religious Protestants, and so on. But the basis of fascist political power has always been rooted in the lower middle class during periods of crisis, when that part of the population is thrown into a reactionary mode. And it also involves an alliance, and this is important, it always also involves an alliance with sectors of wealth, with monopoly capital, and or today monopoly finance capital. So there's an alliance between the lower middle class operating in a very reactionary mode and the very top of the wealth hierarchy.
You write that Trump in his election campaign had a, quote, neo-fascist strategy of enlisting mass support through racist and nativist appeals to lower middle class insecurities while allying with core elements of the ruling class. Can you expand on that thought, please?
Well, that really is the traditional neo-fascist strategy, is to it plays up to the reactionary elements of this part of the population, particularly when there isn't a strong left, so that the lack of a strong left prevents them from having an analysis that might incorporate them within a more democratic project. And the problems that are experienced by people in this sector of the population are then blamed on immigrants, racial groups, a whole nationalist, ethnic, racist philosophy is promoted. And there are criticisms, of course, of crony capitalists at the top and of the elites, but this is accompanied by attacks on marginalized populations everywhere. And this is a phenomenon that we know historically, and that is the basis of creating a fascist or neo-fascist movement. They rely particularly on sub-intellectual appeals to emotion. They draw very heavily on people who are in fairly relatively privileged positions with respect to the working class, but are less educated. And all of this is part of what's made fascism work in the past in its different forms.
You write that ultimately, however, the neo-fascist project, like classical fascism before it, relies on an alliance of the lower middle class with monopoly finance capital, leading ultimately to the betrayal of the movement's mass base. Is this already happening here in America? And in whose interest do the fascists really govern?
Well, it's very complicated. If you look at, say, Trump's White House, a lot is made in the news of the fact that there are two wings that are in conflict. One is represented by Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and the other one by Steve Bannon. And Kushner basically represents the financial sector, real estate, big capital. He's more of an economic than a political figure. While Bannon represents the alt-right within the administration, Breitbart, and the neo-fascist political strategy specifically aimed at the lower middle class that was so important in bringing Trump into power. Both of these elements are necessary to the overall working of this political strategy. But Trump's allegiances and, well, of course, Kushner's are mainly to the rich, to capitalism, to monopoly finance capital. So ultimately, he will follow that course. But he has to hold on to this popular lower middle class base, which is, say, the rear guard of the capitalist system, as C. Wright Mills called it. And so he has to constantly tell them that he is fulfilling his pledges to them. In fact, Steve Bannon has been shown with a whiteboard with all of Trump's pledges, mainly to the lower middle class, and with a list of his pledges on immigration, actually checking them off. And then this is put on Breitbart and actually over through the whole media. And this is meant to say that he's fulfilling his pledges to the lower middle class. But the big play, like the tax reductions, the reduction of the corporate tax from 35% max to 15%. These things, or the 75% reduction in regulations on business that he's promised, this is really about playing to monopoly finance capital, to big capital, and that's where Trump really will take his stand. But if he wants to win another election, if he wants to move forward, he somehow has to hold on to this lower middle class, particularly political base, and the alt-right, and that whole strategy as well. So it's a difficult thing to accomplish. There are betrayals that are likely to occur in this process. You know, ultimately, if he gets reelected, which isn't beyond the realm of possibility under these circumstances, he will probably betray his lower middle class base big time, because he won't need them anymore.
John, Trump got only a majority of the vote and less votes than Clinton got by 3 million. Do you think we should take any comfort in that fact?
Well, you can take comfort in whatever you want, but the politics is about winning, and the Electoral College system is the system that we have. The whole basis of the higher vote of Clinton's was a higher percentage in urban areas, but the political system is set up so that rural areas have more clout than the Electoral College system. Basically sets it up so that the elections aren't based simply on the majority, and the key to Trump's Electoral College victory was he managed to win in the Rust Belt states, in the Midwest, which had formerly been in industrialized states, blue collar, and he managed to win in these states. Of course, you could say that given that a lot of people refused to vote, many more refused to vote or didn't vote than in the case of Obama's last election, that it was more a question of Democratic voters walking away than Republicans winning. But whatever you want, however you want to look at it, it still remains true that he managed to pull off the electoral vote in the Rust Belt states, which were traditionally blue states and basically the core of Democratic Party power for many, many years. And this has to do with his appeal to the lower middle class and to privileged sectors of the working class that have been really hurting in neoliberal times. So there's not much comfort in just having a majority of a popular vote. You actually have to win the Electoral College in an electoral contest in the United States. More important than that, it points to the fact the Democratic Party has lost a lot of its connection to workers.
Adolf Hitler came into power in Germany legally. He always pretended to uphold the rule of law, even as he was subverting it. Why is this important, and is this happening now, here?
Well, I think it's important in a number of respects. One of the things is when we talk about fascist tendencies, and the use of the term populism or right-wing populism is often used as a cloak for fascism or neo-fascism to legitimize it and to bring it within the acceptable range of politics. And the whole problem of fascism is complicated by the fact that people think have very little knowledge of what it was or what the basis of fascist state. So they'll look at things like, there's still adherence to the rule of law, or there's a welfare state, and they'll say, well, this proves that Trump is not anti-democratic or is not fascist, or that some people even say, well, he's a centrist or a leftist, and it creates an enormous amount of confusion. We have to understand that when the fascist states came to power, they did so partly through the rule of law, but then they subverted the political and legal institutions, and they promoted a welfare state in Italy and Germany. So it doesn't conform to what people usually think. And in order to have clarity about these things, we have to understand that. Hitler always said that he was sticking with the Weimar Constitution, but he used provisions within the Weimar Constitution's the notorious Article 48, and which allowed the government in an emergency to basically eliminate the influence of the legislature, the parliament. He used such measures like that to take over complete power. And they called the whole process of bringing the various institutions of the state into line, they called it Gleichschaltung. It means bringing into line. And what we see under Trump is, at least initially, but his government's been very beleaguered lately by Russiagate, but we see an attempt to assault the various parts of the state and to bring them into a line with the White House. We see attacks on civil liberties. And all of these things are significant. And if there was a major emergency that arose in the United States, such as a terrorist attack, there's very little doubt that that Trump would use similar provisions that have now been established by law in the United States following the Patriot Act to drastically reduce civil liberties in the country. But it would be done under the cover of legality.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I edited a book of William Kunstler's writings and speeches 13 years ago, and I called it The Emerging Police State, and Michael Ratner wrote the introduction. And we got a lot of heat for calling it that. We said, oh, you're alarmist and so on. But I think that the infrastructure for a police state really has been set up. And I think if there is a crisis, and Naomi Klein has been talking about this recently, if there's a crisis, they can certainly bring those laws into bear and really clamp down on us. Let me ask you this, John. Bertolt Brecht asked in 1935, how can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Would you say that in the last 40 years of American neoliberalism, capitalism, under both the Democrats and the Republicans, they've brought forth the Trump phenomena?
Well, yeah, certainly. Neoliberalism, which was this really, neoliberalism started as a response to the slowdown of the economy, the stagnation of the economy that emerged in the 1970s. And then it transformed itself into basically the political program of monopoly finance capital or a finance-driven and concentrated economic system. And so neoliberalism has been expropriating the assets of the population. It's been breaking unions. It's been eliminating aspects of the welfare state. It's been privatizing education, and so on. And this is part of the. This is really the main trajectory of the monopoly finance capital system at present. And the result has been to turn more and more of the population against what are called the elites, because people are hurting, because inequality is going up massively in the society. And neoliberalism has become so unpopular that in order to stabilize the system, some of those at the top believe that we have to go in a neo-fascist direction, that is, reduce any threat from democracy. And this is a traditional response of capitalism in crisis. And one of the key way to do that is to take advantage of lower middle class that is easily pushed in reactionary directions, particularly in terms when there is a weak left. So if you look at Breitbart, which is the central organ of the alt-right, and of course Bannon still manages Breitbart, he's been allowed to do that within the Trump administration. Breitbart is funded by monopoly finance capital, by some of the biggest billionaires in the United States, and it's aimed entirely, though, at the lower middle class and privileged sectors of the working class, and promoting nationalism, racial hatred, patriarchy, anti-immigrant attitudes, and so on. And this is a political strategy to create a neo-fascist political spectrum that can stabilize the system, because the system is characterized now by economic stagnation, long-term economic stagnation, prone to financial crises, and there will be another big financial crisis. And by declining U.S. Economic hegemony and rising inequality. So how do you stabilize such a system? they have basically moved, or a spectrum of the capitalist class is moving towards neo-fascism as a way of stabilizing neoliberalism or replacing it.
John, we just have a few minutes remaining. Do you think building and reforming the Democratic Party is a productive way to fight back against Trumpism?
Well, the short answer is no, but the long answer is quite a bit longer. You know, Bernie Sanders is historically one of the biggest critics of the Democratic Party and always said you really couldn't change things within the Democratic Party. But he has moved now towards trying to shift the whole nature of the Democratic Party. That's incredibly difficult to do, and I don't think it will happen. But more important than that is that if we're going to build a electoral political movement, you have to have an extra electoral movement. You have to build a political base at the bottom of society. You have to build alternatives. There have to be other organizations at the bottom of the society and mass organization, mass movements that define their own objectives. And I think it will only be rational and systematic if it's socialist, aimed at substantive equality for all people. But this has to happen, and the Democratic Party is controlled by certain political elites, and more than that, by the capitalist class. What we have to do is build a political momentum of a different kind at the base of the society, and that could conceivably change the Democratic Party into something else, or we create something else. But without the base movement, nothing will happen. We'll have Democratic Party is dedicated to neoliberalism and capitalism, and it really has to be abandoned ultimately if we're going to go forward.
John Bellamy Foster, how can people listening today follow your work?
Well, I'm editor of the Monthly Review, so you can find all sorts of things about me in articles on Monthly Review. And in this context, I have a little book coming out called Trump in the White House, which will be out in a couple of months, and that will be a low-cost, short book and something that will present these ideas more systematically.
Well, we look forward to talking to you when the book comes out. We'll help you launch it, John.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder, John Bellamy Foster. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
About 2 years ago, when I was in Berlin, I won a prize called the Hans Litten Prize, really for my work around Guantanamo. Hans Litten was this well-known trial lawyer who cross-examined Hitler 2 years before the Reichstag fire. And they had named the Bar Association in Berlin after him when the East and the West came together. And I'd thought a lot about Hans Litten. I'd read everything I could get my hands on. And then all of a sudden, just recently, I came across a book called Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. And I always thought Litten was an important figure, important not only for demonstrating what was happening in Weimar Germany before the Nazis took power, a few weeks before the Reichstag fire, but as much also as the lessons that we have today about what it means to stand up to injustice and what it means to take away law, to what it is to live in, as Hans Litten's mother said, in a non-legal state, in a state where law has no usefulness or efficacy. Well, today we're really pleased to have with us Benjamin Carter Hett, who is the author of Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. In this book, it tells Litton's story, both the story of him as an incredibly aggressive lawyer trying to really put down and get rid of, before they had a chance, get rid of Hitler and the Nazis in the early 30s, but also Litton as a political person, and Litton really the side of him that had this sort of involvement with religion as well. It's an extraordinary book. Hett is able here to recreate the entire cross-examination, the three-hour cross-examination of Litton at the trial. And this book is really an opening and an eye on what happens to a criminal justice system and a justice system, and what happens to a country as seen through a criminal justice system where law is beginning to weaken and eventually have no usefulness at all. And of course, the story of Litton is, in the end, is heroic, but it's also very tragic. And today we're really pleased to have with us Benjamin Carter Hett, who is the author of an amazing book called Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. Benjamin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So I was intrigued. I mean, you know, I know who the figure Hans Litton is from my own history, and I read your book a few months ago, and I just thought it was fabulous. But why don't you just give us a little bit of background? What is this book about, Crossing Hitler?
It's the story of several things, I think I would say. First and foremost, it's the biography of this man, Hans Litton, which is something I wanted to do because I came across him in the course of some research I'd been doing, and I thought, well, here is a remarkably admirable man, a complex and fascinating man in many ways, whose complexities, I think, in many ways embody what his country was about in the 1920s and 1930s, and the story was not too well known. So it struck me that this was just simply a story that I thought should be better known and should be told. Over and above that, I think because of what Hans Litton did and the sort of centerpiece, in a sense, of his legal career was the incident that forms basically the centerpiece of this book, which is an approximately three-hour cross-examination he did of Adolf Hitler in 1931, so a couple of years before Hitler was Chancellor of Germany. In the course of this cross-examination, Litton basically cross-examined Hitler into the ground on the issues of the advocacy of violence of the Nazi Party and the very explicit calls to violence that the party made to its stormtrooper units, while at the same time Hitler was trying to present himself as a legal operator. And that incident, in a sense, also, it made Litton very much a major figure in the German legal world, and it established him as a major opponent of the, at that time, rising Nazis. Therefore, it sort of embodied a lot of the political struggles of the late years of the Weimar Republic.
Yeah, let's lead up to that, because I think one of the fascinating things about the book, I'd known of Litton very little. I tried to do research myself. I never could find much, so I was completely amazed by your book. But you sort of look at pre-Nazi Germany, which, of course, is the night of the Reichstag fire, is the next day, I guess, is when Hitler takes power in, what, February 1933.
Yeah, Hitler took power a few weeks before that. The Reichstag fire was the event that sort of crystallized his rule.
So you try and look through what's happening in Nazi Germany, in pre-Nazi Germany, through the trials.
Yeah.
Not just this one, but others. Give us some of the thoughts, some of the threads that are running through Weimar Germany then during this period.
Weimar Germany, it's a fascinating era on any number of levels. And one of the things that makes it fascinating, and I think in many ways sort of topically interesting for our time and place, is the extent of the political divisions and the ferocity with which the political divisions were being fought out. And law was very much a part of that, because what the courts did, how the legal processes worked, how the criminal law worked, that was something that was very much at the center of a lot of the political fights, divisions, battles in the Weimar Republic. And inevitably, the political struggles of Weimar, the ongoing battles between Nazis and social democrats and communists and so on, they inevitably ended up in various ways in the courts. So there's a common saying about the United States that the courts follow the election returns. And in a certain broader sense, I think what that gets at is the point that courts are not some autonomous realm where something happens that's apart from society. Inevitably, society's conflicts and its tensions spill into the courts. I think actually to study any period of history, if you study the trials of any society of any time and place, it will teach you all kinds of fascinating things about what that society is like, what the culture is like, what the assumptions are. But most certainly in a time of such monumental political fights and divisions as Weimar Germany. The legal system, the courts, what's happening in the laws were a sort of perfect way to capture a lot of what was really at the heart of those battles, those struggles, the differences in that society.
Why don't you give us some of those differences that are going on and maybe take us through the trial that Litton was involved in, and after that we'll go back and look at Litton again.
Sure, okay. One of the curious things about politics in the Weimar Republic is that they had a very aggressive notion of what in America today we call ground game. And what that means is basically each political party had its own gang of thugs. And the job of these gangs of thugs was basically to go out day after day, find the other party's gangs of thugs, get involved in basically rumbles with them, all with a view to really literally claiming territory, grabbing hold of neighborhoods, taking control of neighborhoods to ensure political domination. And so what you have going on in major German cities from about 1929, 1930 on to Hitler's coming to power is basically you have a civil war going on in nightly installments as these gangs all fight it out.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Benjamin Carter Hett, author of an extraordinary book, Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. Let me go back to that trial, because this is the famous part of this period in Germany. Of course, Litton is very young, 28 years old or so at the time, I think.
That's right.
And he actually calls Hitler to witness stand. And what I got out of it was the purpose really was, as you just sort of illustrated, was Litton wanted to show that the Nazi Party was essentially a violent party. And by cross-examining Hitler, he tried to prove that. But Hitler was going to have a problem because he wanted to be a legal party in Germany. And, of course, you couldn't be a party that was extra-constitutional in Germany and be legal. But at the same time, he didn't want to disappoint the base of his party, which was this working-class violent aspect. So Litton had Hitler in a very rough position.
Yes.
So why don't you go through some of what happened in that very famous cross-examination? And as you do that, was this a big deal, even in 31, calling Hitler before he took power?
It was absolutely a big deal. Hitler was, at that point, a major figure in German politics. A few months before that, in September of 1930, his party had scored a big electoral win, and they had drastically increased the size of their parliamentary caucus. And so Hitler had become, at this point, a really major figure. And so to pull this man, who already by that time many Germans thought would end up at some point in power, to pull this man into court and cross-examine him is a huge deal. And it was a stupendously brave thing to do, even in 1931. As to the conflicts that this trial involved then, Hitler was really in a very potentially awkward place. Just a few weeks before the cross-examination took place, it was early May of 1931, in early April 1931, there had actually been a revolt from within the ranks of Hitler's stormtroopers, the SA. The SA always being the much, in a sense, more radical component of the Nazi movement, the more revolutionary, the more violent. As you said, Hitler's desire to pose as a legal constitutional politician, which Hitler wanted to do tactically because he wanted to reach middle-class voters who would be put off by the revolutionary violence of the SA, but would vote for a leader they thought was, you know, in our terms, kind of tough on crime. And so Hitler was trying very hard to position himself as this legal guy. But meanwhile, in fact, the stormtroopers are going out, as we've said, night after night, engaged in this sort of very calculated pattern of political violence. And that's how the stormtroopers want it. And they are absolutely frustrated with this legality, which they see as sort of, you know, wimpy and conformist that Hitler is trying to engage in. So Litton here sees the wedge that he can drive right through. And Litton is hoping to really drive that wedge deeper between Hitler and the stormtroopers and then possibly fragment the whole Nazi movement. And at the same time oppose the hypocrisy in Hitler's claims to legality while at the same time he's running these stormtroopers in this kind of ongoing civil war. I think he was also hoping that he could do what in fact he did do, which is then open up a trap whereby Hitler would one way or another have to perjure himself. And then you could at the very least have Hitler for perjury, which was an offense that German courts took very seriously in those days. There were a lot of perjury prosecutions in the Weimar Republic. And if you could expose Hitler to that, and open up that risk that he would be prosecuted, then you might be able to stop him right in his tracks.
Fascinating. Now, let's go forward a little bit. First, what happened in that trial finally?
Ultimately, it was a trial of four Nazi stormtroopers who were charged with firing more or less randomly into a dance hall where a communist hiking club was holding a dance. And three of the young communists were wounded in the gunfire. And Litton was actually there as the advocate for these three young men who had been wounded.
Right. Under German law, unlike America, you can, if you're in a criminal suit, you can actually represent the victims as part of the prosecution.
That's right.
And that's what
that's
was
right.
going on in Germany.
Yeah, they call it being a private prosecutor. And right. You can prosecute the case alongside the state's prosecution. So that's what Litton was doing. The outcome of the trial was that three of the four stormtroopers were convicted of relatively minor forms of violent assault, and they received minor prison sentences of approximately 2 years each. What everybody was watching this trial for, I mean, nobody much in the German media, which focused very heavily on this trial, nobody much was actually all that concerned with what happened to these stormtroopers. Everybody was really concerned with what was going to happen to Hitler. There was a trail of consequences that came out of this trial for Hitler and shows, in a sense, how well-conceived Litton's strategy was and how nearly it worked, except it didn't quite work, of course, as we know. But.
Right. There is a actually, you have a picture in here, I think. Is it? Yeah, here, of Hitler in the Berlin courtroom.
Yes.
It's not the same trial.
It's not the same trial.
But it's amazing to just see him standing at a desk in a similar case. So that's the trial. It takes place in 1931. I think we should do two things. One is we should go back and look at who was Hans Litton. How did he get here? And then let's go forward and see what happened as a result of crossing Hitler.
Sure. Well, Hans Litton, he was born in 1903. He was born in the town of Halle in central Germany. His father was a law professor. His mother came of a family that had produced a lot of academics and clergymen. These are very prestigious professions in Germany, still today and certainly then. One of the things that's interesting and really formative about Litton's family background is that his father came from a Jewish family but had converted to the German, what they call the Evangelical Church, basically the Lutheran Protestant Church, so that he could have a career. Because basically you would not have much chance of getting named a law professor in pre-World War I Germany if you were a practicing Jew. But if you converted to the Christian Church, then all bets were off and you could make a career. And so Hans' father made a brilliant career, actually. He was a very successful professor. He became dean and ultimately rector of his university. Became something of a minor celebrity, actually, in East Prussia, where the family eventually settled. They settled in the city of Königsberg. So Litton came from this mixed background. And what's striking about Litton is almost from the beginning, from his early childhood, he was engaged in this fierce, fierce feud with his father. He and his father never seemed to like each other, and it just got worse and worse as Hans got older. And as part of that feud, he started really emphasizing his Judaism, I think initially probably as a bit of a slap in the face to his father's conversion and conformity. Litton made quite a production of, as a high school student, of going to the synagogue and walking about with his prayer book, even having friends from the Hasidic community in his hometown of Königsberg. All of this, of course, drove his father completely wild.
His father at this point wants to be a very good Prussian, essentially.
Yes, exactly. Yes, right. His father prided himself, as he wrote, on being a Prussian officer, a Prussian civil servant. He wanted to be absolutely in the mold of conventional Lutheran Prussian society. So with all of this, with his political complexity, the fact that his far-left political affiliations made him a bit of a hot potato, especially in West Germany after the Second World War. Nobody much wanted to deal with that. Conversely, it made him a hero in East Germany, although
He was dead by this time.
He was dead by
this
time,
yes. We'll get to that. But
the East German regime had to sort of downplay the fact that Hans Litton hadn't actually liked the Communist Party too much, which was a bit awkward for them. So there's awkwardness there. People who approach him in terms of his religious motivation, it's always a bit awkward. Do you consider him Jewish or Christian or both? So there's something there. Always it's a bit awkward for some people. So he's a very complex man whose record offers, you know, tremendous things to admire, but also things that are often off-putting for some people.
Okay, and what happens then? 1931, the trial that he's cross-examined Hitler is over. Reichstag fire is what night?
It's February 27th, 1933.
What happens to Litton then?
You can imagine, given what he had done to Hitler, given this three-hour, very public, very well-documented humiliation that he had delivered to Hitler, because he had succeeded in making absolutely clear these contradictions that we've talked about within Hitler's movement and within Hitler's attitude to legality. All of this came out.
I should say, I remember when I first ran into Litton, I tried to find very much on the cross-examination and could not. And what you've done here is reproduce as much as you can of the cross-examination, and that's
yes.
another part of the story, how you did that. But go forward with then what happened after 1931,
sure.
and then let's talk about how you got that cross-examination.
Sure. Hitler had come within an ace of getting prosecuted for perjury as a result of Litton's cross-examination. He was investigated. Hitler had to give a deposition to the authorities explaining why he hadn't perjured himself, and the authorities mulled this over. By the autumn of 1931, had decided not to prosecute him, but it had
obviously come close. Hitler was actually looked at for perjury?
He was looked at for perjury, absolutely, as a result of this. So this is something that shows, I think, how well-conceived Litton's strategy was and just how close he had pushed Hitler to very serious jeopardy. However, as we know, sadly, it didn't happen. Hitler didn't get prosecuted for perjury. We come now to February 1933. Hitler is now chancellor. And after 4 weeks as chancellor comes the Reichstag fire, which served Hitler's new government as a pretext, basically, to completely gut the Weimar Constitution, in particular, all protections for individual liberties and freedoms, in particular in the criminal justice system. And what followed that very night was the arrest of about 5,000 people across Germany whom the Nazis had identified as opponents or potential opponents, and Litton was one of them. So he was arrested and taken first to the Berlin police station, and then over a long process dragged from infant concentration camp to infant concentration camp. The concentration camps began springing up very soon on in the Nazi period of rule. And he started to suffer and be exposed to barbarities that are unbearable to even think about and read about. It was certainly painful for me doing the research and the writing of these parts of the book, and I imagine it's not always the most pleasant read, but it underscores what this man had to suffer. He was beaten, tortured repeatedly. The Nazis wanted to interrogate him for information on his clients, who by and large had been leftists. And through all of this, Litton showed an absolutely remarkable physical courage and an absolutely remarkable solidarity with clients that he refused to betray, even under torture, even under the most unbearable imaginable beatings and so on. And in a sense, this dragged on for years. By about the end of 1933, the authorities had clearly decided they probably wouldn't get much information from him. He had even gone so far as to try to take his own life so that he wouldn't betray his clients, a remarkable dedication to attorney-client privilege. Even though the authorities had decided they wouldn't probably be able to pump this man for much information, they would not let him go. And what opened up now was a long, heartbreaking period of years in which Litton's mother and certain other friends and family members and many prominent people abroad, political figures from Great Britain and elsewhere, campaigned publicly and privately for Litton's release from the various concentration camps he was in, always running up against the wall, always running up against Nazi authorities saying, no, this man is too dangerous. He will go abroad and he will spread propaganda. There's no way we can let him out. This kept up year in, year out, until finally, by early 1938, Litton was so broken, really, after 5 years of this brutal treatment. And he recognized, I think, correctly at that point, that he was never going to get out. And he told a number of his friends in Dachau, I said at the outset, I'll give this 5 years and then I'll make an end of it. And at about the precise 5-year point, as a matter of fact, in early February 1938, he took his own life in the Dachau concentration camp.
Now, this part of the story I know is extremely well documented and very moving as I went through it. And you know, even before I read the book, it was the one part of Litton's story that I knew a little bit about because his mother wrote this book called Beyond Tears.
Yes.
And I remember, as I said to you on the phone when we talked about it, I said I suspected there might have been a Jewish link there, but his mother never mentioned it all in the book. This entire book that was written in 1941, I think.
Yes.
And he was a well-known figure. I mean, there was an article in The Nation about him and everything in 1941.
Yes.
But it never mentioned that he was Jewish. And I asked you, well, what's that about?
Irmgard Litton's book, his mother's book, in which she wrote, as you say, about really these last 5 years of his life and her brave and determined and ultimately heartbreaking efforts to free him. She wrote the book with a very particular aim in mind. She wrote it after she had gone into exile in Great Britain after Hans Litton's death. She was quite frank about this, too, in her later years. She was advised that the book that she wrote should be shaped in a certain way to appeal to certain kinds of people. What she wanted to do, really, was rally opinion in Great Britain and America against Nazi Germany. She started writing the book just before the war had broken out, so it was important to her to try and rally opposition to Hitler's Germany. She also wanted to try and rally people within Germany, especially some of the people in the conservative establishment in Germany, people like in the diplomatic corps and the army, who she knew from social connections. The Litton family was a very, very well-connected family. These were people she knew, and this was a world that she knew. And she wanted to try and rally conservative Germans to split them from the Nazis. And her thinking was, if you can split some of the sort of establishment conservatives from the Nazis, you can drive a wedge through this regime and possibly break it down. And she thought that under the circumstances of the time, late 1930s, early 1940s, that to achieve this goal, to appeal especially to conservatives within Germany, Lytton would be a much more, in a sense, successful figure, a successful advertising figure, if he was presented as Christian rather than Jewish. And so her book really, really suppresses the Jewish side of Lytton's background.
You can't find it in there. I mean, it's not there as far as I
can think. There's
tell.
Maybe one or two glancing references.
Oh, really? References, I didn't really get it.
But it's, yes, you would. it's very easy to miss, and people did miss it.
A reflection that I had really when I heard his story and when I read your book, of course, is, and one thing that interested me a great deal, is the parallels till today,
yes,
of today. And, of course, one thing that I had early on was that, you know, when his mother went to the Nazis, who she knew because, as you said, social connections, and they said, what? And she said, I want to get a lawyer. And they said, you don't need a lawyer. He's in, I think they called it protective custody.
That was the euphemism for being put in a concentration camp.
And the interrogation techniques were what, called enhanced interrogation techniques or something, or the torture stuff, something like that.
I think they did have
something like that. So the parallels of keeping people in custody without allowing them to go to a court and test their detention were very, very strong for me. That's one part of it, and I'd like to comment on that, as well as comment on really the whole idea of what I think what you said, what happens when the rule of law is no longer really something that is taken seriously in the courts or is malleable or flexible or something.
To me, that's an important theme of the book. And one of the points I make in the book is that you can see the rule of law in Germany, in a sense, going into decay, going into a declining arc from at least a couple of years before the Nazis come to power. There was a process here. There were some extremely right-wing administrations, the Papen administration and the Schleicher administration right before Hitler's, who also had something approaching contempt for the rule of law and who also did their bit to erode civil liberties, bring in new legal procedures, new forms of courts, especially in political cases. Of course, this all gets drastically worse under the Nazis, there's no question. And there are certain things, I think, from a contemporary standpoint that jump out at you in this narrative. I quote something in the book from a man named Werner Best. And Werner Best was essentially the deputy leader of the Gestapo, the infamous secret police of the Nazi regime. And he was a trained lawyer, and so he was sort of the head legal officer of the Gestapo. And in 1935, he wrote a memo about the legal representation or the potential for legal representation of prisoners in the concentration camps in protective custody, as they euphemistically said. And at that point, in 1935, this is not yet the time of the Holocaust. People in concentration camps in 1935 are like Hans Lytton. They're political prisoners, basically. They are people who are there because they're opponents of the Nazis. And so Werner Best wrote, this is not the exact words, but this is essentially a paraphrase of what he said. He said, in this time of national emergency, we cannot let the procedures of the judicial system come into this concentration camp system. He was basically saying it's too dangerous to do that. National security requires that these prisoners be locked up.
And I remind our listeners, we're speaking with Benjamin Carter Hett, author of an extraordinary book, Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. One of the intriguing statements you make in this book is really an example of how people should act in the face of injustice. Yeah. And I think this book is a lesson about that and a discussion of it, but you also say it's a double-edged sword.
Yes.
You sort of say Lytton, yeah, he acted bravely, but there were consequences for acting bravely and not just to him.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little more?
Sure, yeah. Lytton was a thoughtful, dare I say, deep man, and he thought a lot about what he did. On the one level, there's no question Lytton was a man who sacrificed himself, quite literally sacrificed himself for his beliefs. He could have gotten out of Germany before Hitler arrested him. Friends and family said to him, it's time to go, get out. And Lytton steadfastly refused. He said, no, my clients need me. The workers can't get out, so I have to stay. He quite openly sacrificed himself for his dedication to his clients, to their vision of a better society, and in a certain sense to the rule of law. His very close friends, Max and Margot First, who risked their lives and very nearly lost them trying to free him. They arranged an escape attempt from the concentration camp, which went awry. Margot was arrested and imprisoned, and Max ended up in a concentration camp for a while. They eventually got away. These were people, again, who their bravery and nobility, I think, is one of the really strong, appealing elements of this story to me, partly why I wanted to write the book, to sort of just do honor to the nobility, really, of these people. At the same time, Lytton himself once wrote in a very striking essay about what he called the double edge of the deed, and he wrote that it is impossible to do good anywhere without the flip side of that doing harm somewhere else. He said that's impossible, and his own life and his own career shows that. I talk quite a bit in the book about the costs to his family of his advocacy. This was something that was really movingly brought home to me when I spoke to Hans Litten's niece, a lady named Patricia Litten, who's the daughter of Hans's youngest brother.
We talked about the cross-examination, and as I said, it's fully reproduced in the appendix, and of course parts are used in the text of the book itself. But how did you put it together? Where did you find it? How's it different than what we do here with cross-examinations today?
It's one of the challenges, actually, of doing research on German trials, and this is something I've done quite a bit of. I wrote a previous book, too, that dealt with German trials. They were never and are not now stenographically recorded officially in the way that American proceedings are. So if you want to find out what was said in a German courtroom, it can be a challenge. And really the source that you have is the newspapers. Back in the Weimar days, the newspaper reports were much more extensive than they are today. And if a trial was in any way interesting to the public, or newspapers assumed it would be interesting to the public, they would send stenographers to court and they would record it. And the newspapers would run transcripts, not always full transcripts, sometimes partial transcripts, but to some extent transcripts they would run in the papers. And since the Litten's cross-examination of Hitler was such a sensational event, and there was tremendous public interest in this, really all of the major newspapers in Germany sent reporters to that courtroom, and they all had transcriptions. And you can go to really any major newspaper in Germany from May of 1931, and you'll see transcripts of the cross-examination. The challenging thing is they're all a little bit different. and some of it you can easily imagine why. The newspaper world of Weimar Germany was incredibly diverse in terms of the ideological spectrum. You had communist papers, you had Nazi papers, you had liberal papers, you had Catholic papers, you had social democratic papers, everything. So to some extent they all have their axe to grind, and you can see how this sort of precipitates out in the transcript. And then some of it is just sort of natural factors. Human error, one reporter catches this and not that. An editor decides this part's interesting and not that. You know, you can imagine all that would go on. So all the transcripts are a little bit different. The transcript I have here is sort of inevitably, necessarily, I think, it has to be sort of pieced together. There's one transcript which seems to me to be clearly better than all the others. It's the one that ran in the paper that was kind of the equivalent of the New York Times in Berlin of the day, a paper called the Berliner Tageblatt, which I translate in the book as the Berlin Daily News. And the Tageblatt ran a very long, extensive transcript. From the journalistic reputation of that paper, you can pretty much assume that it would be reasonably accurate. The Tageblatt was a moderate liberal paper, so it didn't have a really strong extra grind one way or the other, in this case, ideologically. And so that transcript is sort of the basis of what I've done, but I've augmented it in places where I think that the transcript in the Tageblatt might not be right, or where there's additional information from one of the other newspapers that seems to me to be plausible, a likely representation of what was said. So my transcript is a bit of a collage in a way.
Benjamin Carter Hett, author of Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand, a really remarkable book about the role of a heroic lawyer, the role of law in pre-Nazi Germany, and with unfortunately, some analogies till today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.